Good morning, everyone. Hope all is well. And that quarter past nine instead of eight suits you. I still see a few who log on quarter past eight, but I assume that's by your own will. Today, I'll talk mainly about confidence intervals and confidence limits, but this should be conceptually not too hard, so it's not a lot. And then I'll talk about Simpson's paradox, which is one of the pitfalls in analyzing data and statistics. But first, let's start with Tuesday's exercise on the random digits. And see, the random digits, you had to test which were which. And perhaps I should start by just showing you the results. Or the solution. So here are the solutions for the data sets I made this year. And as you can see, all your random digits or near random digits were in the if sample. Now, what were the other samples? Well, D was digits of pi. And G was the truly random. And so those two, you probably couldn't see any difference. In the B sample, I had simply taken 100 numbers and I've put them down. And then I had taken the same 100 numbers and shifted them by a random digit. So one became two, two became three, nine became zero. Shifted them by one or by, you know, between one and nine, and then repeated them. So they were not random, but it's not that easy to test if they're random or not, because they should do reasonably well in, for example, a frequency test. Then I had one where just this every seventh digit was copied from five digits before. That's another way of breaking the randomness. And then I have some ice cube data where I simply said, I won't take the first digit. I'll simply take the second digit of whatever that data is and put it in. And then finally, I have one where I use four Gaussians. So I choose between those four Gaussians and then I choose the, again, the second digit. And well, it's not exactly uniform, but it's a little hard to detect that it is not. Yeah, so those were the solutions. And how could you test them? Well, there were some of the things that we discussed, namely, you could test if there were as many high as low values or as many even as odd values. And with those two, you can actually do also a runs test. And that would have caught some of the issues here. For example, with the 100 with a shift, if those did not fulfill the run, then by shifting them, I wouldn't help on that. So that you would amplify any statistical fluctuation there, which would repeat itself. Then you could also look at how many times did you get the same digit? And people tend not to want two digits of the same type in a row if they put in random numbers, and especially not three digits. And with 6,000, we should have at least 60 cases of three of the same digit in a row. Usually you don't get that when humans punch it in. So then people suggested quickly a frequency test. And here, zero is usually well, underrepresented in a sample made by humans. So, and then you can do a sequence test because you can do it with two digits in a row. Now there are 100 options, but there are 6,000 sequences of two, which means you should expect to get 60 in each. And that should, of course, be uniform. You could also do it with three in a row. If you do that, well, then there are 1,000 options and you could only expect six in each. And so now, it's more, you can't expect the errors to be Gaussian anymore. What can you then do? Well, then you can say, but I have 1,000 counts. let me put them into a histogram, and now I should see that follow a Poisson distribution, because the chance of having exactly these three is small and n is large. And then I can also catch if some are very close to the mean and a few, maybe even just one, is far away. Let's say 1, 2, 3 was overrepresented. You would catch it that way. You wouldn't catch it in many other ways. And you can do it with 4, 5, and 6. But the lower you go, or the higher sequence you go, the more of them are simply going to contain zero. So it should still follow a Poisson distribution, but I would say beyond 5, it probably gets a little academic. Yeah. Now there are more advanced tests, and there are people who actually made a career of that. And I think the most famous guy of that is George Massaglia. So George Massaglia was a mathematician and a computer scientist. And he became famous by realizing that when people were producing pseudo-random numbers with linear congruential generators, and you can see here how they're done, well, then things actually fall in planes in hyperspace. So let's see how that looks. So you see more and more random numbers in a three-dimensional space, and they look reasonably random. But when you get a lot of them, suddenly you see effects here. And so his paper, Random Numbers Fall Mainly in the Planes, becomes very apparent when you do a lot of them. So this is called the Massaglia effect. And what Massaglia then did was he developed tests of random numbers, because this was the early development of computers. And it was realized quickly that random numbers would be what's behind cryptography. And also the quality of them would be behind how well simulations worked. So he made a whole battery of tests. There's not a single test that will, you know, immediately see all effects. You can always cheat a test. You can design random numbers, which are not random, but cheats this test specifically. So he made a whole battery of them. And what he did was then to put them on a CD and send them to 1,000 researchers around the world. And they copied them on, and this became known as the Die Hard tests. And he had a career based on that. And today's equivalent, I would say, is putting a smart algorithm on GitHub and writing a paper describing it in all its simplicity. Now, why do they fall in planes? That is because they were not truly random numbers, but they were made in this linear way shown here, which is a smart way of, and computationally very cheap way of making seemingly random numbers, but in high dimensions, it doesn't work necessarily, as Massaglia showed. All right, let's jump to today's subject, which is the confidence intervals and confidence limits. Here we are. Let me get rid of some of the other things so my screen is a little more clear. Yeah, well, let's start with confidence intervals, and then confidence limits will follow. So a confidence interval is a range of values, so an interval, that acts as a good estimate of the unknown population parameter. So, for example, if we measure the average height of students at KU by just measuring our height here in class, then we would do an average, and then we would say, all right, we have a standard deviation, and we divide it by square root n, because then we get the uncertainty on the average. And then we say, well, let's just take plus minus 2 sigma. So z would be 2 here. Then this is an interval where we feel that the correct value should be with 95% confidence inside this range. Okay, so we don't know the true average height of students at KU. You would need to measure all to know that. And that's, of course, a picture that fluctuates. But from a sample of just us, we would still have a pretty good idea. The standard deviation height is probably 10 centimeters, and there's 100 of us, so we would get 1 centimeter, and then 2 sigma out, that would be plus minus 2 centimeters. That's at least what I would guess. And why wouldn't we divide by square root of n minus 1 here? Well, remember, the square root of n minus 1 was in getting the standard deviation. So it's when getting this number that we divide by square root of n minus 1. But afterwards, when we have the standard deviation, which is enlarged by what you say, then it's divide by square root to get the uncertainty on the mean. And it should be said, look, if we got 100 heights, if it's n minus 1 or n, I would say, frankly, I think it's reasonable enough to just go ahead. But true, if you really want to be correct, that's the way. So here's a confidence interval. It has a bound, and all of this sounds pretty easy. In reality, you want a confidence level, which in this case was 95%. And what you're doing is that you want the probability of being inside the range to be some value, could be 95%. And so what you're doing here is an integral from a lower limit to an upper limit of the distribution as you think it is, and this might be discrete from measurements, to get that. Typical values are 95, but people also use 1 sigma or 90 or 99. Those are often used, I would say. But there's a choice in choosing x minus and x plus, because we can require a symmetric interval, meaning that x plus and x minus are equally distant from the mean. We can require the shortest interval, so x plus minus x minus is at a minimum, so we choose the interval just to get the most measurements in fast. Or we can require a central interval, which means that the integration from x minus to mu is the same as from mu to x plus. Now, fortunately, when things are Gaussian, things are easy, the three are the same. But otherwise, it's usually three that's used. So let's say that we do 100 experiments and we set a 95% confidence interval. Well, here the true value is 5. And then we choose to measure this 5 by taking a sample of 3 measurements. And then we calculate the mean and we calculate the 95% confidence interval. And then, as you can see, once in a while, the true value is not gonna be inside of this. But we should expect that. We only made a 95% confidence interval. Once in a while, well, 5% of the times, it should be outside. Then you could say, okay, but what if we, 3 is a low number, let's measure it more times. So now we do it with 20. Well, the uncertainty on the mean certainly goes down, as it should, but then so does the size of the confidence interval. And again, we should expect some outside and not the same ones as before. So that's what a confidence interval is. And it's used very frequently to report scientific measurements, especially in higher dimensions. Then it's a sort of a domain or a coverage. So here is an example from cosmology, where in a parameter space with 2 parameters, you say, well, with 68% confidence, we feel it must be inside here. Here's the 90. And here are actually bands with different samples. And then later you have more data and suddenly the confidence interval shrinks a lot, as it should with higher statistics. And you would say, well, we believe that these are the confidence intervals. In this particular case, This is what was published with 40 supernova. Now there are many more in this analysis, but the confidence interval sort of range or area here has not shrunk very much, sort of pointing out that the more statistics you get, the more you realize that there are many systematic effects in it, which were not included here. So it doesn't really fall at the same rate. Within my own field, here is a confidence interval of what was the expected Higgs mass. So that's shown here. And then the lines here show what it actually was expected to be. And now we know it to be straight on that line. So, and then what about, what is confidence limits then? Now we have an interval for, well, we measured something and, well, we want to know where it fits in. But imagine that you're trying to measure something and you find nothing, right? It might be the ether, or the planet Vulcan, or dark energy, or the Higgs particle. At some point you find something and things become a confidence interval. But before that, how do you do things? How do you make, how do you report that result? And it's the thing that reporting a result is important. Also, if you find nothing, the question is, how do you report a null result? Well, you describe your experiment and what you get. And then you set a confidence limit, saying something of the order. What would you have discovered if it had been there? If the ether had affected the speed of light by X percent, we would have seen the effect with 95% confidence. And that's a confidence limit on the size of the effect. If the effect was really there, then we would have most likely seen it, but we see nothing. And then where can you set that limit? And the lower you can set it, the stricter you've bounded what any possible effect. And for Michelson and Morley, in fact, they were measuring the degree of dragging of the ether because the Earth was moving. Now, they didn't set a confidence limit because, well, statistics was still in its infancy. But at least what they did was that they published what would they have expected the effect from the ether to be and what did they observe. And also, they don't have uncertainties on their observations, but we can almost, from the jitter of this, get an idea of what the uncertainty is. And now it's actually a hypothesis testing, saying, does it follow a flat line or does it follow this variation? And clearly it follows a flat line instead of the other. And now people might say, yeah, but what if part of the effect was there? Well, that's where you set the confidence limit. And how you do that can be very complicated. So let's just take the simple example. And I won't go beyond that in the exam if I include this, just so that you don't think we'll be doing a lot more than this. So the simple example is that, well, if you go to Blydomsvej on a day, and again, you look for red cars, and you observe zero, well, are you going to claim that red cars do not exist on Blydomsvej? No, it might just be that, you know, you didn't get to see one. And mentally, what you should be thinking is there can be some chance that there are red cars, but it must be low, right? Because you observed quite a few cars and there were no red cars. So it should follow a Poisson distribution, and it's a Poisson distribution where you happen to observe zero. So the question is, assuming a Poisson distribution, how large can you make lambda and still have a good chance of observing zero? And so if you want to set a 95% confidence interval, well, then the upper limit turns out to be 3. So if lambda is 3, then the probability of observing zero is 5%. So that's how you make that limit. If you only want to set it at 90%, well, then you would set it at 2.3. Now, what if you do observe two red cars? Well, suddenly you've made an observation and becomes a confidence interval. And in the Poisson case, again, as this would be, you would say, well, I will now assume lambda to be 2. And I want to contain 95% of my probability. In what range around this do I need to set it? Well, from 0.35 and up to 6.3. And that would be your confidence interval if you observed two red cars out of many in a day. That is it for confidence limits and intervals. Are there any questions? Please go ahead. No? It should also hopefully be sort of relatively, if you have a measurement and it's uncertainty, well, then you can turn it into a confidence interval. And if things are Gaussian, here's the formula. And if things are Poisson, then here's the table, assuming you have a low number of observations. And if things are multidimensional, then admittedly, it's not that easy. So it's not infinitely hard, but you know, it takes a little thinking. And then, all right, now people think, would this car example depend on the number of cars seen? I think in particular, if few cars are seen. Yes, Casper, that's right. I assumed a large number of cars. And if doing the experiment, you would of course say that. But let's say you look at 100, already n is large and probability is small, and you should be fine. Isn't it quite arbitrary where we can set the interval and limits? I wouldn't call it arbitrary. It depends on how strong limits you want to set. But you know, if you want to set it at 95, then it's not arbitrary. Then it's fixed where they end. What about a prediction interval? Are they used much? Yeah, there's a slight difference between the two in the assumptions behind, which I can't recall right now. But they're very much alike. It's the same line of thinking. And Sarah asks, would we always use the table as the reference for Poisson lambda? Yeah, if you observe a lot and have a few successes or none, that's the table. That would apply to all Poisson cases, no matter if it's cars or particles or galaxies or whatever. Could you repeat how one decides the value of Z in the confidence interval calculation? Yeah. Z is the number of sigmas, in this case, that you want to include. So if you want to put a 68% confidence interval, then that corresponds to plus minus one sigma. That's why they're good to remember. And then that would correspond to Z being one. If you want to set a 95% confidence interval, you would use Z equals 2, right? You'd take double the interval simply because now you would on the Gaussian assumption, assume that you get 95% in. What if you want 90? Well, then you will have to choose 1 point, I think it's 698, in order to get 90%. That's the integral of the Gaussian. And that's what we use one of these classic formulas for going from probability to number of sigmas. Number of sigmas is simply because the Gaussian plays such a central role that once in a while we won't turn it into a probability. We'll simply say a number of sigmas. And then, you know, if it's 1, 2, 3, then people know. And it's easy to calculate often. All right. Does higher statistics normally mean larger confidence intervals or vice versa? I would say vice versa, because with larger statistics, your standard deviation remains the same, right? You still measure with the same uncertainty, but the uncertainty on the mean goes down. And so the confidence interval shrinks, which is why, you know, having many measurements is typically good. If you want to test if, for example, the speed of gravity is the same as speed of light, well, you would love that interval that you feel 95% confidence that things are inside to be small, and then see if it coincides with the speed of light. Would we combine standard deviation plus confidence interval to make sure we capture all likely occurrences of something? Well, we can never capture all. That's exactly the sort of points of the confidence interval and the confidence level. CL equals something often in plots. That's because we can never catch all. You can always be 5 sigma away. It's just unlikely. Could you repeat how one achieved the mu low and mu high for the red car example? Yes, gladly. And it's great to answer all these questions. It sort of makes me more confident that that you get the point. So that's really good. Thank you for that. So how did I get these numbers? Yeah, Nikolai, you have to define likely. And if that is 95%, well, there you have it. So let's do this example again. Let's say I observe 1,000 cars in a day on Blydamsvej, just to crank N up, and I observe 0 red cars. Would I make the claim that red cars do not exist on Blydamsvej? No. Would I like to observe an upper limit, saying if I do the same thing again tomorrow, and if traffic and car colors don't change, then where would I expect it to be below? Yes. And what would I do? I would say, well, if lambda is 2.3, then drawing the Poisson distribution, let's just do that. So I'm going to draw the distribution here. Here is N red observed, and here's probability. All right. And for lambda equals 2, I'm not going to write that because that sucks to write. It would look roughly, I think, like this, and then very small. And then it continues out. I'm not going to draw that either. So lambda is 2.3 roughly here, and that's why 2 is the most likely outcome. But there is 10% down here. And that means it's okay for lambda to be 2.3. That's the highest value where you still have 10% chance of observing 0. So we're not making the claim that there are no red cars. We're just saying if we want to set a confidence limit at 90%, that means having 10% in our observation, namely 0. Here's the 0 bin, here's the 1, 2, so on. 10% down here, well, that's still consistent, right? That could be 2.3 and it will still be consistent with what we observe. So in that way, going back to the table, we would set an upper limit at 2.3 red cars per day or out of 1,000. If we wanted to say, well, we want a 95% confidence limit, we do the same thing, but now the value turns out to be 3. I hope that answered it. Is there a function that does this for you? Yes, you have the Poisson function and you can ask for the cumulative of it. And I don't know if there's a function which you can ask, I want, you know, 5% in the zero bin. But actually, you can calculate it from the Poisson distribution itself, it occurs to me, because you want the probability in the zero bin to be some value, and then you can solve for lambda. Otherwise, you can do it numerically. Crank up lambda and see what the zero bin is, and at some point it passes wherever you want to set the limit. When I say lambda, then it's the mean value for the Poisson distribution, right? It's the expected number to get. Yeah. All right. With that, I'm going to move on to two things. The first is a poll. And I'm going to launch it now. And the poll is simply a quick, well, I want to ask you how the course is going for you. And part of what triggers this poll is that I see the number of students that are on Absalon. And I know some are just there following the course and, you know, on the sideline and so on. But we've been sort of seeing that the number of students following lectures, but especially exercises, have been falling and falling and falling. And we simply want to make sure that we provide for you, that you feel that you have a place to go with questions on code or concepts or other problems and whatnot. And I will here also say that so far we have good capacity. We have five very, very capable teaching assistants. You know them. And if you have problems, sit down and, you know, whenever you encounter a problem, whatever the sort, write it down and then join the exercise sessions and say, look, I have a list of five problems. Can we do a breakout room, just you and one of the TAs, and go through that list? Please do that, because what we don't want you to is to sit stuck under these not very easy circumstances and say, my code doesn't run and I don't understand if I'm even doing the right thing. Let me instead just do something else. We at least want to make sure that you have the full support, or at least as much support as we can provide for you. So please, please fill out, and we'll use, 3 minutes, 2 minutes past now. But I would very much like essentially all of you to vote. And meanwhile, I can say that for the rest of today's lecture, we'll talk about Simpson's paradox based on a fun slash interesting story from Berkeley back in the 70s. Though it won't get as juicy as you probably like.
Charles, may I ask where the poll is, please? I don't have a link for a poll.
Yeah, it should appear on your screen. People are filling it out now.
Nothing.
Okay. Well, that's a good excuse for not filling it out. I'm not sure what to do. I can see people. Well, Ithemius says you can find it next to participants and chat. I get a window up, but all right. We're missing 14, and I'm going to close this poll in 20 seconds. So please just give it your best shot. And then we'll move on to Simpson's paradox. And I can say it's a pitfall in statistics making claims about what correlates with what. So ending in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Please, the last ones. Well, I think we up there. I'd gladly like to share the results with you. So I hope you can see them now. All right. I can see, fortunately, it's a very small fraction that doesn't get the points at all. If you don't, please come to the exercises and ask there. All right, Nikos, it's okay regarding submitting. And I'm glad that I record the lectures. Actually, your voting percentage triggers me to think that that should be done always, even if things are not very high quality, because if when we go back to real lectures, it won't be that clear. But if they're useful to sort of rewatch and say, what was that point towards the end of the lecture? Well, cool. The exercises, they're hard and hard to solve. I see that most say they're easy to understand but hard to solve. Yes, they don't solve themselves in a short while. It does take a lot of effort to do. They're hard to understand but easy to solve. Please come to the exercises and ask, you know, if I'm not clear on some of the questions. And we do run, I mean, we run them through and have the TAs who hasn't taught this course before, read through them and say, you know, do I understand them? I know that's not the same, but then please come. They're hard to understand and hard to solve. All right, then certainly I hope to see you for the exercises. Can you solve the exercises reasonably well with alone or with your group? Mostly. Sounds good. And by solving, as we said, there's no, you know, full solving. But, well, I hope you don't leave them saying, I didn't get anything of this. How did the course exercises, how did you do before? Well, you came in person or with group? All right. And I see the same fraction who are not doing the exercises that hardly get the point of the lecture. At all. I don't know if these are the same, but well, if there's a relation there, then that's not unreasonable. How do we do it now? All right, people do them by themselves. I hope all them who do them by themselves simply say, look, I know that I can just log on to Zoom and get help, and otherwise write us mails. But I'm okay doing it in myself. And this corresponds well to those who mostly solve, find the exercises easy to understand, because then you can work on them yourself. Why am I not in the exercise? But I am. Good. The majority of those who are not in the exercises is, and I'm glad to see that, because you don't do the exercises during the exercise session. Well, then I hope you're there for the opening of the lectures where I go through them, or that you use the solutions. You get the exercises via GitHub. Cool. Not from a friend. Good. And you consider the solutions. And here there are a few who say which solutions. And maybe the answer is it would be good if I posted them also on the course webpage. I'll see if I can accommodate the last 5% by that. Thanks a lot. That was a great input. Stop sharing and then go to the case of Simpson's paradox. So here we are. Simpson's paradox. In 1973, University of California, Berkeley, were considering who applied to the university and who got admitted. And it seemed that there was a bias against women because a smaller fraction of women were admitted. Ooh, is that really the case, or is there more behind the data? So here's a paper that says, well, let's take a look at this. Measuring biases is harder than is usually assumed, and the evidence is sometimes contrary to expectation. So what they were looking at were simply how many were observed to be admitted of men and women, and how many would you expect if they were equal? All right. So if they were equal, there were more men who applied than women. But if the ratio of those admitted to denied had to be the same, you would get these numbers. But in reality, you got these numbers. And so there was a significant difference here. And it was certainly statistically significant. And how would you do that? Well, remember the contingency table, the 2x2 table. You would assume the things were not correlated, admitted or denied between gender. And so you could get a p-value for this being just by random. Well, if you put those numbers in, you will get a very, very small probability. And here you can see the chi-square is 110 with a 1 degree of freedom, probability zero. And there's a difference in the fractions as well. You could also calculate the uncertainty on the fraction, but the contingency table is exact. So back to this, what is happening? And the paper here said, let's go through it and note. We are aware of the pitfalls ahead in this naive approach, but we intend to stumble into every one of them for didactic reasons. So that's what we're going to do as well. We're going to follow the paper and stumble into these. So first they said, all right, how many departments are there? And how many show a bias? And they considered in both directions. And it turned out that only a few showed a bias and mostly against men. Okay, that seems counterintuitive. And then they find they find 6 departments biased in the opposite direction compared to the 4 in the direction against women. Okay. And then they also sort in the departments, the remaining 85. And in this case, you know, they say they only look at relevant data. And relevant data there should just trigger an alarm and say, what does that involve? How did they sort in it? And it turned out that 16 departments either had no women applying, okay, that is hard to do the math, or didn't deny any students admission. Okay, then again, you have zeros in the table and it makes sense. So what they then did was to make a hypothetical case, because now they make 2 departments. They say, we make a department of mathematics and a department of social warfare. And in mathematics, the men that are admitted is 200 and denied is 200, and women admitted and denied is 200. And that's exactly what you would expect if things were even. Whereas in social warfare, you now have just 50 men applying, 150 applying, 50 admitted, but 100 denied, and same ratio for women. But the difference being that this department is easier to get into than this department, and here a lot more men apply, whereas here a lot more women apply. So when you make the grand total of it, when you add it all, then suddenly a difference appears. And this is the basis of Simpson's paradox. You seem to get a correlation because you combine different samples. And so the effect is that effects for Simpson's paradox is an effect for groups which disappears or even reverses when considering subgroups. So in a subgroup, there might be no correlation, But when you put them all in one big group, as we just did, you get a correlation. And so what they looked at was, is there a correlation between how hard it is to get in and the fraction of women applying? And there was a clear correlation. So women tend to be, the proportion of women applications tend to be high in the departments that are hard to get into and low in those that are easy to get into. To some extent, the women were more ambitious. They went for all the places that are hard to get into. And that's why the effect appeared. And trying to draw it, so to speak, it might be that conceptually, you have men, or here's one group, it doesn't have to be men or women. Here's one group where there's a positive correlation between X and Y. And here's another group where there's a positive correlation between X and Y. However, when you combine the two, there's suddenly a negative correlation. Well, it's clear that combining groups that are very different, they shouldn't be combined. And also, it can be drawn out here. If this is how many apply and this is how many are successful, then the success rate is the slope here. And so the slope of the two blue vectors is bigger than the slope of the corresponding two orange vectors. But when you add them, suddenly the slope of the orange vector is bigger than the slope of the blue. And so that way you get this apparent paradox. So this is called Simpson's paradox. And then I'll simply jump to give a short introduction to today's exercises, which are that, there are two exercises. We can go to the week four here. And one is the is on fitting peaks. And here, I want you to try to play around with fitting peaks. So it's also a fitting exercise. But if you have a background with a huge peak on, it might be a 20 sigma peak, then you can measure the rate of things going on and give some confidence interval. When the peak becomes small, suddenly you might not be 2 sigma above. And so you may rather want to set a confidence limit on this. So you should play around with that. And it's also an exercise where, I made a background and a signal. And to begin with, where do you start the fit for the signal? You started where it was generated. But in reality, if you're looking for a peak in a background, you probably don't, in some cases, don't know where the peak is. If you know where to expect the peak, then you, of course, fix that value. And you just ask for what is the width or the height. And you might even know the width. Now it's just the height. Do I see something or not? And you should try that in the exercise here as well. But in reality, if you don't know where the peak is and you don't even know the width, all hell is loose. You have some fluctuation background and you try to fit a peak and it will run around and see if it can find just anything. And I want you to see that happen. The other exercise, which is mostly for illustration, is just a case of Simpson's paradox, where you have different age groups and you put them together. And then it looks like, the older you are, the more healthy you are. But once you just try to color according to age, then suddenly it becomes apparent that it's the other way around. Yeah, that is about it. I'll stop sharing for now. And as always, recommend that you take a good long break, stretch your legs, get some tea, and then please join us on Zoom. It doesn't have to be right away, but collect questions and ask them, and we'll be here. And looking forward to a good day. And then finally, there's a question. In the project, you said that we should show our results with three decimal numbers? No, have you said? And the answer is no. You should quote things to the correct number of significant digits. I think that's the aim. And if there is a case where you would say, all right, I do something and I see a slight improvement, or I include a systematic uncertainty and I see a slight disproven, you may be allowed to include one more digit than the significant ones. But mainly you should just keep the number of significant digits as should be done. All right, with that, I think we end here. See you for the exercises.